So when I say calculate chi in the coincident limit, or I forget, maybe I say phi, same difference, just with a factor of a. So by this, I mean calculate this in the Bunch Davies vacuum, okay? Now, if I just had De Sitter space forever, right, there was no radiation dominated era that began inflation in this problem, then this would be the mode function, right? So this is just the Bunch Davies vacuum, right? And this would be associated with some creation and annihilation operators. We'll call them A, right? Such that A minus on the Bunch Davies vacuum would give me zero, right? So if I build this thing out of the V's, by build it out of the V's, I mean, remember we wrote chi as some integral d cubed k 2 pi cubed, and then in here we had the a minus k v k e to the I k eta plus the raising operator, right? So I can build chi out of these mode functions associated with these creation and annihilation operators, right? And then I'll get one answer here, right? So that's an assumption about how I set up my mode functions, right? Which was based on some physical condition that I want to be starting in the Bunch Davies vacuum. So in this problem, we did something a little bit different. We added this radiation-dominated era that happened before the De Sitter era, right? And so there's another set of mode functions associated with that. Those were these U's that you solved for in the previous parts. I forget which part that was, but you solved for these, right? And so in this sort of large wavelength limit, then this is what you find, you should find approximately for what U is. And now we can build an equally valid operator, chi hat, from this set of mode functions, U's, and some different creation annihilation operators, the B's, right? So here, chi is this integral, but now I've got these UKs associated with another set of raising and lowering operators, right? Creation annihilation operators. So with this set of mode functions, I'll get a different answer if I calculate the coincident limit of the two-point function. Okay. So that's the distinction. So are there any other outstanding questions? Hopefully that helps you finish that one up. Okay, if there are, then come see me. Okay, so yesterday in the tutorial, I asked you to calculate the temperature of the static patch of De Sitter space in two dimensions, okay? And I understand that it was a bit long, so no one got the answer in the end, or maybe a few of you did, but not everyone did. So what you should have found is that this number density of particles with frequency omega in the static patch follows this black body spectrum, right? A Planckian spectrum for the number density. And so you can just read off the temperature here is h over 2 pi. And I asked you how big h had to be to cook a hamburger. Okay, so h, the scale of the horizon, the size of the horizon, has to be about a micrometer to cook a hamburger, okay? So you can only cook a really small hamburger. That would be like a nano burger that you could cook, but you'd need a nano man to eat it because only a nano man would fit inside of the horizon, right? So just to, I don't know, talk about this for a second, reinforce this point. So on this Penrose diagram, this is the static patch right here. So this is the piece that I wanted you to look at. And so there's a, you know, sort of a maximum size for anything that can fit in the static patch, right? And that's of order the horizon size. Because if I made something bigger than the horizon size, then it would just get ripped apart by the expansion of De Sitter space. There's no way for it to causally, even just no way in principle for it to hold together. So if I had a hamburger bigger than a micrometer, then all the pieces of the hamburger that were bigger than that micrometer size would just inflate away, right? That there'd be no way for me to keep that hamburger stuck together, no matter how much stuff I put on it. So this is really an intrinsic limit on the size of any stuff, right? So the horizon. Is an intrinsic limit on the size of any system. And if I live in the static patch, so that's any inertial observer. They live in the static patch, like us in our universe with dark energy. We live in the static patch. So we see, you know, some galaxies and whatever really far away from us, and they or if we were to draw the sort of standard cosmological slicing, it would look sort of like this. And galaxies would follow trajectories that are going outwards. And so to us, all of these distant galaxies, which are just going with the flow, look like they're moving away from us. And eventually, they're gonna go outside of our horizon. So they will be gone to us forever. Goodbye. So far in the future, anything that's not gravitationally bound to us will just be gone. It's going to be a depressing world in about, I don't know, 100 billion years from now. It's going to be the local group and nothing else, and everything else would have just gone outside our horizon. And then what are we going to be left with? Well, we're going to be left in a pretty big universe. Like, you know, for us, H inverse is about 3,000 megaparsecs, so we've got a lot of room to play in. But don't stray too far, otherwise you'll never come home. So we got a lot of room to play in, but also there's this temperature. Okay, so we live in this universe with an intrinsic temperature because we're living in this static patch of De Sitter. But of course, you know, it's much colder than what we need to cook a hamburger, right? So it's linear. So here this was what, like 300 Kelvin or something like that? And that's a micrometer. So that's 10 to the minus 6 meters. Okay, so our temperature would be this, but sort of scaled down by the size of the universe, right? So that's 3,000 megaparsecs. So that's like 10 to the 20 some meters. I forget the exact number, right? So this is something like 10 to the 26 meters or something times 300 Kelvin. So the temperature for us is this ridiculously, you know, it's like 10 to the minus 30 or something Kelvin. So it's some ridiculously small temperature, right? So we're gonna, so we've got this, but we have this intrinsic temperature, right? So if we were in hamburger world and we're trying to measure, I don't know, something about the hamburger, right? Then whatever device we have is really small, so it probably can't have a lot of degrees of freedom. And furthermore, it's coupled to this thermal bath. So it's probably going to be really hard to measure anything very precise about this hamburger, right? Well, I don't know, does it have pickles on it? Does it have mayonnaise, mustard, whatever, right? I'm not going to be able to tell very well because any pointer that I have on some instrument is going to be jittering around because the temperature is, well, it's not that high. I guess it's room temperature, right? So maybe we can measure if there's pickles or something. But this, the fact that there is a temperature in De Sitter space, coupled with this, the fact that there's a limit on the size of any system, implies that there's a limit on the precision of any measurement. Right? I can't get rid of this thermal bath. It's there. And I can't make arbitrarily big systems, because if I make them too big, they'll just fall apart. So living in de Sitter space implies that there is a limit on the precision of any measurement that I could ever possibly imagine doing. The reason we don't care about that so much in our universe today is that this temperature is ridiculously tiny. So you know, unless we're talking about measuring something with some extraordinary amount of precision over really long timescales, we don't care. But nevertheless, in our universe, just as a philosophical point, there is a limit on the precision of any measurement we could ever possibly imagine doing, especially on stuff that's at really large scales. And furthermore, if we wait a really long time, and all of these galaxies and stuff go outside of our horizon, and we're left by ourselves, there's always going to be thermal fluctuations. And so if we wait a long enough time, then there will be any thermal fluctuation you could ever want. So for example, we'd be, I don't know, rematerialized out of this thermal bath e to the 10 to the 120 years from now, and you'd be taking this course again, but you know, my name would be John or something, and you know, there would be 50 of you, because people would be super interested in cosmology then. So there's really a lot of deep philosophical issues associated with the fact that de Sitter space has this intrinsic fundamental temperature. So I just thought I'd mention some of those issues, because I personally find them really fascinating. But bottom line, what you should have found is this yesterday. The one difference between what we had been doing for particle production in a Robertson-Walker universe is that here, when you do the Bogoliubov transformation, any one frequency depends on an infinite number of frequencies in the original coordinates, right? So actually, we could have seen that. In the example that we did, where we had omega varying with conformal time. So it looks something like this, where we had this in state, this mid state, and this out state. So the plane waves in the in and out state were identical, and that's why I could write vk out just as some linear combination of vk in and vk in star. But if I tried to write the solution in the mid region, would I still be able to do that? Nope, because the solutions to the wave equation in the mid region have a different frequency. Okay, so in the mid region, if I wanted to write this as a linear superposition of the vk ins, actually I would have to integrate over all frequencies of the vk ins, right? I have to integrate over all k. So we could have seen that in this example. And that was really the only technical difference to get to here, just so you're aware of that for the future. Okay, so were there any outstanding questions from the tutorial or any of this nonsense that I was just talking about? Okay, we'll talk about it again in e to the 10 to the 120 years. So, okay, recap from what we did in lecture yesterday. Actually, why don't I just start over? So for yesterday, we made the statement that free scalars have a Gaussian spectrum. Okay, and that we found just by calculating the two-point function for these operators, chi hat, in some vacuum, and this is always going to be equal to vk squared over 2 times the delta function of k minus k prime. Okay. And this guy we had seen before when we weren't talking about quantum expectation values, but we were rather talking about ensemble averages, right? And this thing here was basically proportional to what we were calling P of K. Okay. So yesterday we also, and why are they Gaussian? This comes from the looking at the moments or realizing that free field theory is just an infinite number of simple harmonic oscillators. And the ground state simple harmonic oscillator wave function is Gaussian. So that means that the wave functional for a free field is an infinite product of Gaussians, which is a Gaussian. So everything is Gaussian. So we also calculated this real space two-point function at equal times. And this thing we wrote in the suggestive form, dk over k delta squared of k. And then if we care about things that are not coincident, this was sine lk over lk. And then you all reminded me that for a massless scalar, that's a conformal field theory, and then everyone taking Pedro's class, of course, knows that that goes like 1 over L squared. And this thing, delta, was just defined as delta squared is just k cubed vk squared over 2 pi squared, okay, where this L was just the magnitude of the difference between these two positions, x and y. And so we can relate this P of k to this delta. So this is proportional to P of k with the k cubed on it, right? So if we want to be consistent with what we were doing before, we need to be careful with this k cubed. So then we studied the most interesting example for early universe cosmology, which was De Sitter space. And in De Sitter space, we found this vacuum, right? So what is the proper vacuum to use in De Sitter, that's Bunch-Davies. And why is it proper? Because there's a physical condition that we can impose, which is just that at short distances, I wouldn't be able to tell that I live in a De Sitter space, so the mode functions should behave like they live in flat space, right? As long as I'm talking about scales that are much smaller than the horizon. And for any scale that I pick, it's much smaller than the horizon if I take eta, going to minus infinity. And so I just require that this then looks like 1 over square root k e to the ik eta. And then we found the general solution, and then noting that the original thing we were interested in, which was phi, is related to chi by a factor of a, then in the Bunch-Davies vacuum, we found that this spectrum of fluctuations for phi was h over 2 pi. Which is also the temperature of De Sitter space. So there's some parity there, right? So you can think about these quantum fluctuations in a sense as a manifestation of this finite temperature of De Sitter space. We get the same answer. Okay, and furthermore, this result, I guess I should preface that this was on super horizon scales, which because A goes like negative 1 over h eta, means that super horizon scales correspond to k times eta much less than 1. So as eta goes to negative infinity, then did I get that totally backwards? Yeah. No, that's right, yeah. Now, why am I confusing myself? So,
do you mean that it goes to that vacuum on small scales or large scales?
On
small
scales, but every k is going to be
small
compared to an infinitely large eta. No, on large scales. Small scales, so large k. So look here, so I need to make k extraordinarily small if eta is very large to be super horizon. So effectively, for any value of k that I could possibly be interested in, at very large negative eta, it's subhorizon. And I want subhorizon scales to behave like they live in Minkowski space. So by imposing this condition, by going to really early times, then any mode that I could possibly care about is going to be subhorizon. Because k eta will always be much bigger than 1. So here, all k satisfy k eta much greater than 1. As eta goes to minus infinity, right? So any mode that I care about will be subhorizon at some point. Okay, so that's where we left off. And then I prefaced this by saying that we were going to look at the coincident limit and show that there's a divergence. So are there any questions before we do that? So in this coincident limit, we've got the thing we want, which is the expectation value of phi squared in the vacuum. And that's related to the expectation value of chi squared in the vacuum by a factor of a squared, right? And so this is going to just be given by the integral dk over k from 0 to infinity of delta phi squared, right? Because delta chi is related to delta phi, again, by that factor of a. And this as we showed above, for these large scales, is going to be given by h over 2 pi squared. Okay. We're now, in going from here to here, I should probably limit myself to talk about some maximum value, right? So you can think of this as the sort of infrared part, and then there's going to be some UV part. And so this UV part is going to diverge as k goes to infinity, but that's the same divergence that we get in Minkowski space. So let's just kind of peel that off and forget about it for now. But here, we're also going to get a divergence because I've got dk over k, And formally, I should start at zero, right? So that's going to give me an infrared divergence, a divergence at large scales. So in the homework, you guys figured out in part G, once you finish it, adding this epoch of radiation domination is gonna fix that for you. So you can have an infinitely old universe as long as it's not inflating forever and not have this divergence. It's gonna regulate that for you. So let's say now instead of invoking some detailed scenario like I asked you to do in the homework, we can just say, we can postulate, you know, if inflation begins at some time t naught, what is this two-point function? So if it begins at some time t naught or some conformal time eta naught, then that's going to impose a minimum value for k, right? So at that time, remember this is only really valid when we have superhorizon modes. So k min is sort of going to be bounded to be eta naught inverse, right? So this is the largest scale that we can contemplate, basically something that's as big as this primordial Hubble volume. Okay. And the maximum k, so the smallest scale we're going to be willing to contemplate, is just going to be after some conformal time eta, you know, what is the horizon size? So the smallest scale we're going to be contemplating is the size of one Hubble volume at eta, right? And so remember, these are co-moving coordinates, so the one Hubble volume is really small at late times, right? It's exponentially decreasing. Okay, so that gives us some limits of integration. So now we'll integrate from not zero, but k min to k max. So our two-point function now would be this h over 2 pi squared. But now my integral is going to go from k min to k max dk over k. So that just gives me a log. So here we'll have h over 2 pi squared log eta naught over eta if I substitute in what we had for k min and k max. Okay. And these conformal times, well, they're related to the proper time, or the t that would appear in the Robertson-Walker metric, where by this I mean the t that's defined like this. Exponentially. Right? So that's the relation between coordinate time and conformal time, proper time and conformal time. So now I can put that in here, and what you'll see is that this two-point function in the coincident limit goes like h cubed over 4 pi squared times t minus t naught. So this thing will just grow monotonically in time. So the longer and longer inflation lasts, then the bigger and bigger this two-point function gets. Sorry? Yeah, thanks. And the physical interpretation of this is that, you know, sort of what's happening is these really long wavelength perturbations are piling up. Because remember, once things become superhorizon, they don't decay. So I make one mode, it grows up to be superhorizon, it stays there. I make another one, it grows up to be superhorizon, it stays there. And then you keep adding superhorizon modes, and they don't ever decay. So it's like I'm taking some original picture. I will attempt to draw this, but I am sure that it will probably fail. So let's say at one time, this is going to be co-moving scale, and this is going to be the amplitude of one of these modes, so we'll call it chi. So at one time, it looks like this, right? And then at a later time, it's going to be joined by another mode. That mode is going to be of larger wavelength because it was formed from some co-moving horizon size that's a little bit smaller. And then he's going to be joined by another mode, which again will be a little bit smaller. But you can see all of these modes have exactly basically the same amplitude, right? And so I'll just keep adding up sine waves of the same amplitude but different frequency as I go longer and longer in time, so that the result at any fixed time will look like some random field here, where the amplitude of that random field is going to depend on t. Because I just keep adding these modes, right? And that's what this is basically telling you. Okay, so it's just this pileup of really long wavelength modes. So another thing we can note is that if we look at the non-coincident limit, okay, so let's look at equal times but not equal positions. So this thing was proportional to this integral k min k max, and then I had our dk over k, but we also had this sine kl over kl. And so by close together, we mean, you know, when this sine kl over kl is of order 1. Okay, so when does it stop being of order 1? That's basically when L becomes of order K inverse, right? And this integral is dominated by the minimum. So this is going to deviate from the coincident limit. When L is of order K min inverse, right? So if I look at distance scales of order K min inverse, then I might find a difference, okay? And so if you evaluate this exactly, what you'll find is that the correlation decreases, right? And that makes physical sense, because if I look at field values that are really widely separated, eventually they should just become uncorrelated. And so what is this distance scale? Well, L of order k min, that's like the magnitude of eta naught inverse. And this, if we turn this into a physical time, is something like e to the minus h t naught. That's just the relation between the conformal time and the proper time. So what physical distance is that? Well, the physical distance is A times the co-moving distance, which is what we had up there. And so at some time t, this physical distance out to which things are correlated is h inverse times e to the h t minus t naught. where this thing you can recognize as the sort of number of e-folds, right? So the number of e-folds of inflation. So the field is correlated on exponentially large physical distances, right? Can anyone tell me why that might be? So the reason is that at any given time, think about where all these Hubble volume, where's this volume coming from, right? It all has the same ancestor. So I start with some primordial Hubble volume here. And then at some time later, the universe has expanded, so you can think about this thing as giving rise to a few more Hubble volumes. And then these ones will give rise to a few more Hubble volumes, and so on. And so the fluctuations that I measure here and here are going to be correlated because they all came from the same ancestor, right? And so some mode that I produce here that's of order the size H inverse is still going to be there, right, at this later time. And so the field values are going to be correlated. So the reason that they're correlated is they all share the same ancestors. So well, if I had some other Hubble volume at this initial time, then that's going to give rise to its own set of ancestors. But the stuff going on at some late time here will not be correlated with what's going on here, right? Because these Hubble volumes at some late time don't share the same ancestor. So that gives you an idea of, you know, sort of how far away you have to go for things to become uncorrelated. So if they're uncorrelated at the initial time because they're causally separate, then they'll be uncorrelated forever in the future. Okay, so there's this divergence. One way to regulate that divergence we saw was to invoke a beginning of inflation. And there's another way to regulate that divergence, which is to have a mass for the field, because everything we've done up here is for a massless scalar. So for a massive scalar, then you can calculate this infrared of the infrared limit of the two-point function. And what you'll find, I won't do the calculation, is that this is 3h to the fourth over 8 pi squared m squared. 1 minus e to the minus 2m cubed over 3h squared times t. So I think that should be m squared over h. Sorry about that. So at small times, I can expand this exponential. And you'll see I'll recover what I had for the coincident limit of the massless scalar. But at large times, this thing saturates, okay? And then I just don't get any extra contribution to the two-point function. So this, in this case, there's no infrared divergence. As t goes to infinity. Can anyone tell me why the massive case got rid of my divergence based on that picture that I drew over there? So what did we learn yesterday about the behavior of the mode functions for a massive scalar? What happens to them when they become superhorizon? Do they stay of constant amplitude or do they decay? So yesterday, we found that VK for a massive scalar goes like eta to the 1/2 minus n, where n was the square root 9/4 minus m squared over h squared. And so if we expanded that out for a small m, then this would be like negative 1 plus m squared over 3h squared. Okay, so that's vk, and that means that phi k would be proportional to, because I need to divide by a, I get rid of that negative 1. So this goes like eta to the m squared over 3 h squared. And since that's a number which starts big and is getting small, and that power is positive, this means that phi k decays. On superhorizon scales. So that for a massive scalar, if I looked at phi k as a function of eta, then before it exits the horizon, it would be oscillatory, but then it would just slowly decay as eta goes to zero. So these mode functions decay on superhorizon scales. So now can anyone tell me why we don't get a divergence in the two-point function? So I make these modes, I blow them up to superhorizon scales, but in contrast, yeah, Alex?
Sorry, I have in my notes from yesterday that for m squared over h really small, phi k is constant.
Yeah, it's almost constant. I guess maybe I should have been more clear. So this is, for m squared strictly zero, it's strictly constant. So as I make m squared over h squared even smaller, then this fall off will have a smaller and smaller slope until eventually I get to something that's just totally constant. It's a really slow decay, but it does decay a little bit. Sorry about that. So the reason that I don't get a divergence is that I keep adding these superhorizon modes, but then they're always decaying. So that means that the rate at which I'm adding them, because I'm blowing them up to superhorizon scales, is sort of compensated by the rate at which these new scales are decaying. So that's why you don't get a divergence when you have a massive scalar. Okay. So we'll come back to this probably on Friday, where we'll see that this divergence here can give rise to some pretty bizarre behavior. So if I keep piling up these long wavelength modes, eventually the field is going to increase in magnitude, right? And that, if I have some really homogeneous field, let's say it carries some energy density, so it has a potential. Right, so the mass might be really small, so it decays very slowly. Then what can happen is basically these mode functions pile up and they increase the energy density. And that means locally it looks like the potential energy or the rate of expansion would go up. In some places it will go up, in some places it will go down. And in the places it goes up, the universe is expanding even faster, the fluctuations become even larger, and so it becomes more probable that it will just keep going up. And so this leads to a phenomenon called eternal inflation, but we'll get there. So just to preface that, a little bit of foreshadowing. Okay, so but before we get to eternal inflation and get ahead of ourselves, we're still not done with regular old inflation. So far we've been studying scalar fields in a fixed background with a constant Hubble, right? So now H is not going to be constant anymore, because the place that we're getting this energy density from, this de Sitter energy, is from this slowly rolling scalar field. So at any given time, depending on what the value of the potential is, H will change, because it's given approximately by the value of the potential. Okay, so in particular, also what this means is that, you know, A double dot over A is no longer strictly equal to 2 over eta, because we're not in a strictly de Sitter universe. So A doesn't strictly equal 1 over A, 1 over H times eta. It's going to be a little bit different. So in our equation for the mode functions, let's still stick to a massless scalar for now. We'll fix that up in a second. So if I had a massless scalar living in this universe with an evolving Hubble, then here's how the mode functions would behave. So at large K, then nothing changed, right? The mode functions still have a solution that goes like 1 over square root k, e to the ik eta, because I can just neglect that a double dot over a term. But then the small k which we'll identify as these super horizon fluctuations, well, they obey the equation V double dot minus A double dot over A, VK on zero. And so if we have inflation, then what sign does A double dot take? Yeah, positive. So this is like a negative mass, right? And what that means is that there's going to be growing solutions. So the general solution to that equation, one of them is A, so there's a growing mode. And then another one you can show is that. This turns out to be a decaying mode. For the basic reason that A is increasing. So you can kind of see how that would come out. So we're going to concentrate on the growing mode, because that's what's going to be left over. And so now phi k is vk over a, little a, the scale factor. So phi k sort of still freezes in on these large scales. So that qualitative change, there's no qualitative change, right? These modes sort of expand, they get up to be super horizon effectively, and then they freeze in. So what is their amplitude when they freeze in? To get that, we can basically just say, well, I've got VK versus eta. Starts out oscillatory, and then it just freezes when it becomes large enough, right? When eta becomes small enough in magnitude. And so that is going to happen at some time eta k. So we have this horizon crossing when k is equal to ak hk. And so by matching this oscillatory solution, the 1 over square root k, to this growing solution at horizon crossing, we can solve for this amplitude. The amplitude should basically just be, if we use this relation here, hk over k to the 3/2. And so then that implies that delta phi is the same thing that we had before, but now I have to evaluate this amplitude when the mode that I'm talking about crosses the horizon. So depending on at what time this mode crosses the horizon, I might have something that crosses later, it's going to have a different amplitude, right? Because h has gone down a little bit. So in a universe with an evolving h, then I need to evaluate this at horizon crossing. So this spectrum do you think it's going to be larger at small k or larger at large k? And why? So do modes with small k enter the horizon earlier or exit the horizon earlier or later than modes with large k? Modes with small k exit the horizon earlier. So remember, we had this plot of co-moving scale versus a, say. So during inflation, it looked like this. So a large scale exits the horizon earlier. Okay, so that means small k. So the earlier it is, the larger h is, because we're rolling down the hill, right? And that means that this is going to look like a tilt, right? It's going to have a tilt. It's going to be larger at small k than it is at large k. So delta phi has this, quote, red tilt, because it has a larger amplitude on large scales than on small scales. So there's another source of variation with scale. So for a massive field, there's another correction. Which is that after these modes leave the horizon, they start to decay, right? So I should take that into account when I compute this this spectrum. So it's no longer true that vk is a constant. Vk will now evolve a little bit. So we had before that phi k on superhorizon scales for these massive fields goes. Sorry, I meant to draw that around the eta. Goes like eta to the m squared over 3 h squared in this limit when m squared is much less than h squared. So then I should fix up my my amplitude here for phi So I'll have what I had before, this hk over 2 pi. But now I should multiply this by the ratio of phi at the end of inflation. So let's say I want to measure this thing at the end of inflation over the value that it took when it crossed the horizon. Right? So I should correct for that fact of that this thing is going to decay after a certain amount of time. So this, well, we can just estimate it using what we had there. So this is going to be hk over 2 pi. And then I'll have sort of the conformal time at the end of inflation over the conformal time at which the mode crossed the horizon, all to the m squared over 3 h squared. And eta k, so eta is negative 1 over ah. So that means that eta f is just going to be 1 over a at the end of inflation times h at the end of inflation. And eta k at the time of horizon crossing, that's just going to be k inverse, right? Because horizon crossing is defined as k eta equals 1. So we can put these in here. And what we'll find is that this is hk over 2 pi. But now I've got this k correction. So this goes like now k over h and a and to the m squared over 3h squared. So I get this extra k dependence that comes from the fact that these massive fields decay once they cross the horizon. Okay, so so you'll recall that before we had been contemplating these power spectra, which went like an amplitude times k over some reference scale to the power ns minus 1. So the power spectrum was defined by an amplitude and a tilt. And so now we can just try and figure out, in this case, what is the tilt going to be, for example, right? So I could read off the tilt by taking d delta phi squared, d log delta phi squared, d log k. That should be ns minus 1 if it has this sort of power law form. So we can do that. So in this case, we're going to have two sources of variation. One is the fact that hk depends on k. The Hubble depends on when the mode left the horizon. And the other comes from this decay of the mass term. So this is 2k over hk times dhk dk. And then I'll get from the other term 2m squared over 3 h squared. And this guy, you'll recall a definition that appeared a while back, which was that dh d proper time is equal to negative epsilon h squared. So we had this parameter that measured how quickly Hubble was changing. And so this, then we can use to show that dhk dk is negative epsilon over ak. That just comes from also recognizing that k equals ak hk. So then plugging that back in here, we'll find that ns minus 1, this spectral tilt, is negative 2 epsilon plus 2 m squared over 3
h squared.
So we've got this variation of h. Since h is decreasing, that makes the spectrum want to be red. But then we've got this decay, and the decay is worse for large-scale modes, so that makes the spectrum want to be blue. And so the overall tilt is going to depend on the competition between these two pieces, the decrease of the Hubble constant and the decay of the largest scale modes. And incidentally, as you'll see tomorrow, gravitational waves act like a massless scalar field in a background de Sitter space in a background inflationary universe. I'll raise that up so you can see it, sorry. And I always pick the wrong one, sorry. I need to figure that out. So gravitational waves act like a massless scalar in a background de Sitter space, and so the tilt for gravitational waves is negative 2 epsilon. So tomorrow, we're going to do inflation for real. So this is some field that lives around, it lives in a background inflationary universe. But we've totally forgotten about gravity, in a sense, right? So if I have some fluctuation of the scalar field, it's going to source a metric fluctuation. So I should take that into account. So that's what we're going to do tomorrow. And then after 20 minutes tomorrow, you'll be armed with all of the machinery to calculate the spectrum of fluctuations in any model of inflation that you could ever care about. And we'll calculate that for a few models that you might care about. And then we'll compare it to what we know about the real universe. So so with that, are there any questions? Okay. I have a feeling I destroyed you today. But okay, any questions you have, please ask, and we'll go over it tomorrow as well.